The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This episode of Into the Night was made possible by the unwavering support of our dedicated Patreon donors. Their generosity allows us to delve deeper into the mysteries that await us in the dark world of Five Nights at Freddy's. If you're captivated by the secrets we unveil and wish to be part of our journey, we invite you to explore our Patreon page. By becoming a patron, you not only gain exclusive access to bonus content, behind-the-scenes insights, and special perks, but you also play a vital role in sustaining the future of this podcast. Visit the link provided in the description below to learn more and join the Night Conclave. Hello, and welcome to Into the Night, a Five Nights at Freddy's podcast. I am your host, Nick, and thank you for listening. In our previous episode, we had discussed the surface-level story of Five Nights at Freddy's 4, the story of a young boy, most commonly labeled the crying child or the bite victim by FNAF theorists, who was under the inescapable physical and mental torment of his abusive older brother, as no other immediate authority figure seemed to be present in their lives. Beyond his abusive elder brother, the crying child was also ridiculed by fellow compatriots of his age in his small town, as his tendency to burst into tears whenever he entered into the local Freddy Fazbear's Pizza was seen as humiliating at best, and pathetic at worst. Despite whatever traumatic experience resulted in his robophobia, the young boy still had a soft place in his heart for the Fazbear characters themselves, going as far as to relate to them as his friends, his favorite being his golden Fredbear plushie, fashionably attired with purple top hat, purple bow tie, and the ability to present anywhere and everywhere the boy went.
He's here, he's there, he's everywhere. Who are you gonna call? Psychic friend, Fredbear.
As despite being a seemingly innocuous plush doll, the boy could not only hear the doll speak to him, but the plushie's eyes followed him wherever he went, and it appeared to be capable of teleporting itself from room to room in the boy's home, and even able to apparate wherever the boy found himself. Now, I say seemingly because the game itself never illuminates on if the plush doll talking to the boy is a result of this Fredbear plush being actually sentient. It's quite possible that this doll is nothing more than a coping mechanism, an imaginary friend that the boy gave to life through his own fractured mental state to foster some semblance of a support structure in his life that had none. Or, perhaps, in a world of supernatural possession and lingering spirits, a lost soul found its way into the Fredbear plush and has begun speaking to a fellow kindred troubled soul. It's left pretty ambiguous, to say the least. And that is the hallmark of Five Nights at Freddy's 4. Nothing in it is elucidated on, or concise, or really ever apparent. Despite my abridged retelling of events last episode, I haven't even begun to delve into the game's deeper theme, symbolism, and confusing choices of imagery that plagues and seeps out of every facet of this game. Even my own retelling of events in Episode 4, while I attempted my best to give forth an interpretation that is neutral and true to the game's narrative, devoid of any headcanons or adjacent theories as best as I possibly could, I still had to come to my own interpretive conclusions on certain components of the lore, such as the lack of surrounding adults, the meaning behind who was having the nightmares in the gameplay, and where exactly that gameplay itself coincides within the timeline of the games themselves. Oh, you thought the night gameplay that coincides with the 8-bit cutscenes of said game are from the same perspective and time frame within itself? Oh, no, 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 no. That would make sense and be too easy to follow. This is Five Nights at Freddy's, and when it comes to being disambiguous, to steal a line from the late ruler of Wakanda, we don't do that here. Five Nights at Freddy's 4 is by far the most widely divisive and unagreed-upon aspect of Five Nights at Freddy's lore in the entire series canon, and even when more info is brought into the light about this game, whether it be sister locations, Fredbear camera Easter egg, the dialogue of nightmares themselves in Ultimate Custom Night, or even the FNAF books trying to bring to light certain crucial components of its lore, it feels like all it results in is taking what was widely accepted and flipping what was cohesive on its head for something more unnecessarily convoluted, for the sake of continuously fostering theory crafting. To be clear, it is extremely hard as a writer to leave breadcrumbs for your audience and have them correctly interpret what your intention as an artist is, because you already know your answers and the meaning behind your choices. It doesn't mean then that it will translate to the audience being able to decipher the meaning when they meet your clues with fresh eyes. At the time of FNAF 4's development, Scott knew that FNAF's appeal was its mystery. He made that knowledge public when he made his announcement for the game's free Halloween DLC. Here's the direct quote from Scott himself. Quote,
"You know, when I released the first game over a year ago, I was amazed at how quickly everyone found every bit of lore and story. Then the same happened with Part 2. Fans and YouTubers dug in and found everything. Then Part 3 came out, and once again, the story was uncovered by the community. But then I released Part 4, and somehow, no one, not a single person, found the pieces. The story remains completely hidden. I guess most people assume that I filled the game with random Easter eggs this time. I didn't. But the bigger question is, would the community accept it that way? The fact that the pieces have remained elusive this time strikes me as incredible and special, a fitting conclusion in some ways. And because of that, I've decided that maybe some things are best left forgotten forever."
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is Scott's most poorly aged comment he had ever made. Oh, and if you think I'm being facetious or histrionic about this, think again. Even Scott himself agrees, after the benefit of hindsight, that the plot of Five Nights at Freddy's 4 was too difficult to understand. Thanks to Lewis Dawkins, also referred to as Dawko on YouTube, who has the only available interview with the creator of the series, when the topic eventually gravitated to Five Nights at Freddy's 4, Lewis asked Scott about his personal opinion on the divide the game created from the fan base's endless interpretation of the game's story.
"I don't think that people weren't really happy from a lore standpoint. It had strayed too far from an actual story in a way. Me just saying that, I'm going to get torn apart for even saying that. But the Final Fantasy IV, it kind of went a little too broad. It cast its net too wide for interpretation. I guess that's the best way to say it. You know, it went too broad for interpretation, and that left people unsatisfied. You know, because whereas the other ones, yeah, there were mysteries, four ended up just too mysterious to the point where you really couldn't, you know, there was no real way to figure out what was going on."
Side note, if you haven't watched it yet, I highly recommend any fan of Five Nights at Freddy's horror or game development to check out this interview. It was masterfully done by Lewis and provides great insight into over 3 years of love and dedication one man had to his series and fan base. A link will be provided in the description below, so you have no excuse to not watch it. Except for this episode. You should probably wait to watch after finishing this episode. All this is to say, writers make mistakes, and Scott isn't infallible. FNAF 4 is in many ways the black sheep of the Final Fantasy series already. The story is as complex as it can be, but it's aberrant in that its choice in symbolism isn't as clarinized as previous entries. The usual dry wit and humor that was once present in Phone Guy and would return in later entries isn't here. The story in FNAF 4 is quite somber, with no humor to alleviate the darker tone. The ending itself, while one could argue is better sweet in its resolution, is still rather bleak and morbid. And while the story of FNAF 4 itself is satisfactory and well written on the emotional appeal, it runs into issues when trying to tie it into an overarching narrative as a mainline entry. As a result of Scott's judgment back then, the outcome of which was FNAF 4 languishing in increasingly soured public opinion, it has resulted in FNAF 4 requiring either further game installments and even short stories to help clarify certain elements of its narrative. Except, clarify isn't exactly the right word now, is it? As if Scott truly meant to elucidate on FNAF 4's story, one would think he would prioritize illuminating on the many mysteries within the game's narrative itself. Who exactly was the crying child supposed to be? What was the Fredbear plush doll? What did the crying child see that caused him to be so distraught of being left alone in a Fazbear restaurant? The answer to any of these central questions and more, still up to interpretation, almost a decade later. So, the goal of this episode is, in effect, a complete deep dive into all the lore of not just Final Fantasy IV itself, but also any and all subsequent lore found in the entirety of the Final Fantasy franchise. This episode is an iceberg that will provide you with all the material you need to come to your own conclusions to the story itself, what has to be true in order for future events in the series to happen, and my overall interpretation and conclusions that I think work best from a narrative and storytelling perspective with all the puzzle pieces that have been given. But as always, the truth is in the eyes of the beholder. So all I ask of you all when digesting this plethora of information is to keep an open mind and flexible thought process, because we're going to be bending and twisting the story to a point where it is unidentifiable to the original I had just told you. This is episode 5, What's Seen in the Shadows. To start off with, we should probably not waste any time focused on the main mystery that surrounds this game, the elusive and macabre box. Many theories have surrounded its contents, and even Scott himself has had some particular mentions on what exactly was its original purpose. Wait. Hear that? What is that? Do you guys hear something? Oh my god. All right, fine. Let's get the large yellow bear with bloodstained teeth out of the room. A common misconception made by people when it comes to FNAF 4's story is that the bite victim's head being crushed is the infamously cryptic Bite of 87. After all, if you were to follow the game's storyline from a surface-level, perfunctory point of view, there has never once been an animatronic biting a guest shown. Now, after several prior games hinting at this veiled event, we have a victim, whose head being crushed by the hands of an animatronic, even if by an indirect mean. However, this is simply not the case. If we follow the context clues that the first three games had, wherein which clear dates and timeframes were mentioned on when they took place, we are left with three key points in the timeline. Final Fantasy II, which took place in November 1987, FNAF 1, in August of 1993, and 30 years after the first game, in 2023, the events of Final Fantasy 3 unfolded. So when did FNAF 4 occur? There isn't a paycheck or a date mentioned by any characters in the game, so it's difficult to ascertain. The child's head being crushed seems to be implicit in the narrative's decision to finally answer a mystery that has placated the series since its first installment. Additionally, prior to the release of the game, Scott Cawthon had released various teasers on his website, Scott Games, the majority of which showing off the new designs of the Nightmare animatronics. And deep diving in the source code of the website revealed a plethora of 8s and 7s. Additionally, every teaser also came with the same tagline of, "Was it me?" All this evidence seems to point to this child, the bite victim, being the victim of the tragic Bite of 87. I mean, that's a lot of evidence for it. What else could it be? Well, despite what the game's narrative and even a hype alluded to, this game doesn't take place in 1987. You see, when Phone Guy first explained the events of the Bite of 87, one of the key things that he mentioned was, while this event did lead to the animatronics having their movement restricted during the daytime, the victim of this tragedy had survived.
They used to be allowed to walk around during the day, too. But then there was the bite of 87. Yeah. It's amazing that the human body can live without the frontal lobe, you know?
If this were to be the bite of 87, it would directly contradict Phone Guy's admission, since the fact of the matter is that the crying child did in fact die after his head was crushed in Fredbear's jaw. His final moments can be heard at the very end of the game through the cruel serenade of a flatline. So, unless Phone Guy was lying, which, to be fair, wouldn't be unprecedented for Fazbear Entertainment, the crying child could not be the victim of the Bite of 87. Additionally, to further cement this fact, let's rewind back to the initial question of when FNAF 4 takes place. Remember how in the previous episode I mentioned how during Night 4's cutscene, when the Bite victim returned back to his home, he turns the television on to a cartoon show called Fredbear and Friends. While in the game, this is displayed as various 8-bit graphics on a constant loop. One of these graphics showcases the title of the program, along with a copyright date. That date being 1983. Include the fact that several other games such as Sister Location and Both Have Wanted games also make reference to a connection between the year 1983 and FNAF 4, the logical conclusion we have to make is that Funnest Freeze 4 takes place in 1983, 10 years before the events of the first game, and 4 years before the events of the Bite of 87. This also explains why the yellow springlock suits of Fredbear and Springbonnie are still prevalent and in use at this time. Not enough incidents had occurred to cause Fazbear Entertainment to either dispose or hide them away. Which, yes, that does mean that in the Fazbear Legacy, there were two times where a person gets their head crushed inside the animatronic's jaw during the daytime hours in broad view of everyone. You know, it really puts into perspective the rebrand attempt into Funnest Freeze Hell Wanted. Factual and documented information regarding two people's head getting crushed, and at least 11 children's bodies disappearing or found dead on the premises, culminating in some tawdry amusement park attempting to create a horror attraction off the events which subsequently combust into flames before they even launch it. Despite all of that, they still tried to relaunch what was essentially a failing pizzeria chain and pretend that everything that happened was all one big hoax, and you know what, I gotta respect that hustle. So now that we know where exactly this chapter coincides with the rest of the entries in the Funnest Freeze mythos, the next question seems obvious. Who is the crying child? Since this story is part of the mainline entry and thus directly attributed to part of a whole narrative, we must then ask the significance of why we are seeing these events. After all, it is highly unlikely that Scott would make a story in the core part of his series that had no connection or relevance to the overall plot. So what is he trying to communicate? Well, let's begin discussing the crying child by discussing his life prior to the events we see in the games. We know from the story that he is presented to have no parental oversight at any time, with the only substitute being his abusive older brother in the Foxy Mask, whom we shall refer to as Foxy Bro for the time being. The house the boy lives in appears to be just as neglected, with the room that appeared to belong to his sister barren with a ripped up toy Foxy still lying on the carpet day after day. So we can at the very least make a rational inference that the boy is currently living in a broken household. Additionally, we see that the boy has a strange relationship with the mascot characters of Freddy Fazbear's. While he is comfortable being talked to by his Fredbear plush and calls the rest of the plush ensemble in his room his friends, he still appears to have some form of mental scarring that triggers an affliction similar to PTSD when he's both inside the pizzeria and it is particularly potent when encountering the animatronic characters, in particular, the Fredbear and Springbonnie animatronics. Further evidence from the game's various NPCs suggests the boy's reaction of emotional distress are both well known by similarly aged patrons of the restaurant and lauded as a joke. Once again, we can make a reasoned conjecture that this is implicating that prior to the events of FNAF 4, the crying child solitarily encountered, endured, or witnessed something that mentally wounded him into being directly deathly afraid of the Fazbear animatronics. Now, I'll be honest, that's not a lot to go on, but it's enough to give us a foundation for developing a character profile. As for the events that occurred during the storyline itself, I'll go ahead and keep it brief because we've already covered his story in the previous episode. A traumatic onslaught of horrendous bullying by the hands of Foxy Bro, culminating in his birthday party at Fazbear's Pizzeria, where a practical joke goes wrong as his elder brother and his entourage shove the crying child's head into a Fredbear animatronic's mouth, resulting in the crying child's head getting crushed as the mouth tries to close. The only other additional piece of information that I think we need to include is a secret Easter egg that can occur during the Night 2 and Night 3 cutscenes, where if you walk the opposite way of the pizzeria's entrance, leave the screen, then come back, a set of double doors in the background will open, revealing what appears to be the purple guy helping another employee get prepped in a spring lock suit. While this won't bear too much fruit now, it's still important to note to add that at the time of this kid's story, the purple guy was both active and present in this area. Now, this is slightly cheating, but it is critical to be aware of for this mystery. In future game installments and developed storylines, it is heavily implied that the missing children's incident took place in 1985, which would be 2 years after the events of this game, which makes this line from the pigtail girl about how animatronics hide away your body inside their suits more so foreshadowing things to come rather than an implication that they already happened. Finally, there is the biggest mystery of them all. What can we assume occurred after the crying child died? In a series where ghosts can linger on in many forms, most potently inhabiting all new vessels entirely, the implication made by the plush Fredbear upon his death, with the final line, "I will put you back together," followed by a barely audible flatline, doubly hints that both the crying child perish, but will somehow live on in some capacity. True, this could be viewed as his subconscious giving him relief, his last moments before death being made easier by his foe guardian angel comforting him as he slowly accepts his fate. But given everything we have seen, I believe we can make an educated assumption that the crying child is heavily insinuated to still linger on in some capacity after the events of this game as a spirit. So, with all of this cataloged, the question remains, who did the crying child become? This is probably the most sensitive topic when it comes to this game, as there are various camps of thought of what the bite victim turned into. Some believe that because of the purple shadows on the wall that lowered over him in the pizzeria, along with his fading into the darkness of the post-Night 6 cutscene, gives credence to him becoming one of the shadow animatronics in FNAF 2 and 3. However, that does seem a bit of a stretch. Now, is it as big of a stretch as some think he didn't die and was rebuilt to become a cyborg? No, I really wish I was not joking about that one, but that is a theory people have, and even worse, it was popularized by MatPat. Still love you, MatPat. And I miss you. Call me, be on the show. But, back to the topic at hand, for most, the two primary camps at the time of FNAF 4's release for what the crying child would become was the Marionette and Golden Freddy. And while one of these has since been completely debunked thanks to future content revealing the identity of one without reproach, we're going to look at this with all the evidence the fanbase had when the game was initially released. Because, really, there was ample evidence to support both lines of thought at the time due to the contradictory nature of each identity given would dispense. After all, Golden Freddy was implied to be one of the MCI victims, and the Marionette had a minigame where the implication was he was murdered directly by the purple guy as his first victim. So, either identity would therefore bestow a retcon to the lore, and both were hinted to be the bite victim's identity at the time. With that framework, no one could honestly say one was better than the other, as both worked pretty much perfectly with that framework. The evidence presented for why the bite victim could be the Marionette can basically be summarized into two camps: symbolic interpretation and memes. The latter of which being the striped shirt he wears, which some took to be symbolic gesture that the crying child was the puppet. Looking back on it, that wasn't exactly groundbreaking evidence. It's actually kind of embarrassing that was a point in favor of, but we weren't exactly the most metaphorically literate back in the day, so that's where we started cooking. At the time, we still had no idea when the original MCI had occurred, and given the reference of the pigtail girl, some believed that it already did occur, and that was what the crying child had seen to make him so afraid of the animatronics and why he feared the restaurant. Additionally, the post-Night 4's NPCs also brought credence to this theory, as a good majority of the children had some uncanny similar characteristics to the toy animatronics. Heck, there were even toy animatronic figurines that cutscene itself, something that Scott would later emphasize to be important when MatPat did his first ever Finance of Freddy's livestream. Unfortunately, this theory not only meets a dead end here, but is also dead itself as the Marionette's identity would later be revealed in Final Fantasy VI, aka Freddy Fazbear Pizzeria Simulator, and the crying child was not it. So with that option out of the way, the obvious answer that most would lean towards now would be Golden Freddy, as his Fredbear plush was the closest thing to his heart to the point that he saw him everywhere around him. Additionally, he had got his head crushed by the metallic maw of Fredbear, given more irony to his death that the machine that killed him would vice versa be a representation of the character he saw the most comforting, then later, what he would become. So we already got some heavy symbolism linking both characters together. Additionally, despite the fact that Golden Freddy was presented as the fifth MCI victim, there is a strange aspect of the FNAF 2 Give Life minigame that was never brought up as important but could play a more crucial role than once we realized. In the minigame, which represents how the puppet helped the spirits of the MZI live on inside the animatronic suit, we see the puppet only ever directly helped four children. The fifth child, instead, only abruptly appears on the screen after the puppet helps the fourth, and the screen itself is then immediately hit with a Golden Freddy jump scare. This could be interpreted as the spirit of Golden Freddy not needing the puppet's ability to give lives and give gifts, and were perfectly capable of living on as a spirit themselves. Finally, there is the conclusion to Golden Freddy in Final Fantasy III Happy's Day minigame. Not only is the minigame itself a mirrored version of the Final Fantasy IV Pizzeria, with the placement of Fredbear, and by extension the Bite of 83, and the spirit of Golden Freddy reside at the exact same location, but the child of Golden Freddy can only be appeased and let go once all the other spirits that are there with him are in solidarity, celebrating with a giant birthday cake, recreating the happiest day, as the minigame implies, he never received. I know Golden Freddy is a controversial topic. Believe me, I don't like talking about him myself, and I think in many ways Scott is inexcusable for keeping this mystery languishing for as long as he has. Theorizing about him leads to usually butting heads and angry comments, something that is, oh, so much fun to engage with on the internet. But despite what future installments, Ultimate Custom Night, The Survival Logbook, and even the Tales novella's Ditophobia added to the conversation, the most satisfactory answer from a narrative perspective and a lore perspective is that Golden Freddy and the Crying Child are one and the same. No other alternative. No dual spirit possession, no extra steps. Four games, one story. And this was his chapter. The final chapter. Into the Night will be right back after these messages.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With the identity of our main character settled for the moment, what of the identity of the second prominent character in the story? The Crying Child's older brother, the Foxy Bro. In the previous episode, the conclusion had a final reveal that the Foxy Brother was none other than Michael, the Night Guard from the original Final Fantasy Freddy's, in whom I had similarly inferred to also be the Night Guard in Final Fantasy Freddy's 3. But why is that? If you were to play FNAF 4 from start to finish, you wouldn't exactly find anything that would convey Foxy Bro and Michael being one and the same. So why presume? Well, a lot of the reasons behind the Foxy's identity being Michael are locked behind the forthcoming chapter sister location, where Michael still plays a central role as the player character, with the game's narrative fleshing out his role in the story's narrative in more ways than one. But let's say we don't want to use his location as an example. We want to use only the lore that pertains to Final Fantasy 1 through 4. That's where this bad boy comes into play. The Final Fantasy Survival Logbook, a fun little in-universe Nightguard journal that the first page reveals to have previously belonged to Michael. Now, what makes this book difficult to utilize is the fact that we don't know exactly when Mike had this journal. While the cover would insinuate that this was his journal from FNAF 1, there are plenty of deliberate references to Final Fantasy 3 also inside it. Despite the majority opinion having this logbook being Mike's at the time of FNAF 1, I like to view it in a similar manner, but with the caveat of this being Michael's journal after it was later recovered by the Fazbear Fright Staff, and then refurbished and also mythically corrupted by the time we are seeing it. This would also explain why there exists Fazbear Fright iconography in it, and, in all extended purposes, a FNAF 1 style logbook in a FNAF 3 location. In addition to several strange alterations to the text and stains in the book that signify the object as supernaturally influenced. But we'll talk about that in a little bit. Either way, this survival logbook has a rather peculiar and controversial aspect in it. In various pages in the book, we can see that Michael has a bit of an artistic flair for drawing. Multiple pages have various doodles in the same red ink that was used to write Michael's name in the beginning of the logbook. A lot of these drawings are just a fun little way in humanizing a mainly silent protagonist. I can't deny it is very adorable to see a slim glimpse into Mike's rather childish brain. However, a good handful of these drawings are also used to associate information from various games, mainly Sister Location, and how the Michael in both games, FNAF 1 and Sister Location, are one and the same. But one of these drawings, on page 41, which is a blank page to act as a dream journal, Michael records none other than Nightmare Fredbear, insinuating that whomever owns this journal, that being Michael, is the same person who had endured the night sections in FNAF 4. But wait a minute, didn't I say that Michael was the foxy bro, not the crying child? Wasn't it made clear that the crying child was the one who had the nightmares of FNAF 4 in the previous episode? Well, not exactly. Listen back to it and you'll notice I never exactly stated in the previous episode that the crying child and the child in the nightmare were one and the same. In the same vein that Final Fantasy 4 doesn't state that despite the fact it seems fairly obvious that was the intent. Yeah, we gotta talk about that real quick. I want to make a quick note here that FNAF 4, regardless on your stance or belief, is the most heavily retconned chapter in the FNAF saga when it comes to its lore. While its story has, for the most part, stayed consistent in an overarching sense, it's pretty much has all been changed with the initial release to the point that the story being presented to its actual meaning in the current lore are two different complete beasts. But that's kind of how Final Fantasy canon works. It challenges the more general definition of the term canon, material that is considered to be authentic and accepted as part of a fictional universe. Rather, FNAF's conceptualized canon instead operates more as the culmination of arbitrary decisions of its author Scott Cawthon and his thoughts moving forward while developing his story. This mindset can be best utilized when rationalizing why certain facets, lore, and symbolism in FNAF 4 received much more precedence in future installments, while other pieces of its overall puzzle are almost ignored because it no longer fits with Scott's overall complete picture of how the game's narrative unfolds. In the original release of the game, the majority of the FNAF community, along with any Greenleaf player who isn't initiated in FNAF Lore 101, would interpret that the storyline of FNAF 4 revolves completely around the Crying Child. The Crying Child is who we play as in the minigame cutscenes, as well as whom we play as in the Nightmare sections. Seems obvious. The twist of FNAF 4 as well, after the Bite of 83, is that the nightmares are not happening coinciding with the cutscenes, but rather all take place near the conclusion, after the bite. We can tell this was originally intended to be the case because of the nightstand near our bed, as I had previously mentioned in episode 4, where various props can apparate, including a vase of wilting flowers, a pill bottle, and most damning, an IV drip, indicating that the nightmares the child is enduring are more so a hallucinatory experience, with nearby hospital items seeping in from the real world. If you still do not believe this argument that the Cryon Shadow was originally the character whom had these dreams, then you only have to look at Game Theory's first ever FNAF 4 theory. While not exactly lore relevant, his theory originally had the Crychild's death pegged as the infamous Bite of 87, and Game Theory researched what the aftermath of such brutal wound would do to the human psyche, both physically and mentally, and the result, to partially summarize, would be that a human losing their frontal lobe and surviving would be a human who now had the ability to not feel fear or dread. So the child having nightmares would therefore be illogical. Okay, now, important to know that this is an absolute nitpick, and should not be used as counter evidence for what the games are presenting. This was not even the goal of MatPat, who made the theory. This would be comparable to the 1985 Superman comic For the Man Who Had Everything, a story based around the Final Temptation, where Superman is given an illusionary, idyllic life, where he lives a life of peace on his home planet of Krypton with Lois Lane. Yet, despite this, Superman can read just fine, which is illogical, because you can't read in a dream. But it's fantasy, it's fiction, and it's a trope that we expect to be part of stories like this, so we don't exactly question the validity of his logos, and more so focus on the emotional side of the story it is trying to convey. And even if you don't believe that extended explanation, then it is important to keep in mind that back during the era when FNAF 4 just released, when Game Theory dropped that frontal lobe theory, Scott had commented on his post about how he missed a key detail that actually debunked Matt's theory. Then in MatPat's follow-up episode, he acknowledged that he did in fact mess up, and missed the date on the Fredbear and Friends TV show, which, along with Scott's comments, now implicate that the game was setting in 1983. Now, despite these past comments made by Scott, however, if you were to look to more modern lore, you would see they tend to focus more on a secondary prevalent feature found in the design of the game. FNAF 4 has a strange collection of Easter eggs as it pertains to previous entries in the series. A few examples that are more well known would be Plus Trap being a reference to Springtrap, the Bully's Mask mimicking the mask worn by the souls of the MCI in The Happiest Day, and I'd already previously mentioned that the children the Crying Child passes on Night 4 have strange connections to the toy animatronics. However, the biggest assortment of Easter eggs can be found during the night sections themselves, wherein which, if you look at the environment a bit closely, you start to notice some striking parallels. There was a reason in the previous episode I mentioned how the bedroom had a strange combination of props that were very similar to the previous security offices in FNAF 1 through 3, such as a desk fan, a telephone, and even pictures of the past hanging on the wall. The gameplay itself is also a twisted version of the gameplay in the original Five Nights at Freddy's, with Chica and Bonnie behaving the exact same and approaching from the east and west path from you, Foxy hiding in an alcove and requiring constant attention in order for him to not progress through his various stages, Freddy hiding in the dark, and, quote-unquote, Golden Freddy teleporting. If you don't believe this parallel was intentional, then how do we account for this little effect in the background of the game? While playing through the night, various noises have a random chance of appearing. The sound of a car driving by, a dog barking, or the sounds of pots and pans smashing about, which in itself is also a reference to FNAF 1. One of these sounds in particular, labeled in the game's file simply as call, sounds like this. Oh, that's pretty incomprehensible, but if you were to de-reverb and rewind the audio, you may recognize who is on the other end. That's right, it's Phone Guy's Night 1 phone call from FNAF 1 in the background. If we were to take this literally, it would mean that whomever is having these nightmares also lived through and has memories of Five Nights at Freddy's 1. But then again, you might ask, how does this mean the child we play as can't be the crying child? Why can't the crying child also be Michael? One simple detail. Remember that flat line? The crying child, while it is possible their soul never dissipated, their time inside their own body ran out, which means the crying child couldn't have been having these dreams because they would not be alive during the events of FNAF 1. And just to rub it in even further, inside that survival logbook, that night guard journal, once owned by Michael, and clearly affected in some degree by the preternatural unknown that surrounds Freddy Fazbear's Pizza, we see various images of Foxy the Pirate with the security badge. Foxy the Pirate represents the security guards in the book, the exact same character mascot Michael was represented with in FNAF 4. Foxy is even reading Screw, Bolts, and Hairpins, a magazine that is referenced in Sister Location, where we know for a fact Michael is the POV character. No matter which way you slice it, despite the fact that the story as initially presented quite clearly alludes to the nightmares of FNAF 4 or the dying dreams of the crying child, further entries now elucidate that these are now instead the traumatic dreams of the Foxy Bro, of Michael, that has taken on an unnatural appearance through his memories of working as a night guard at Freddy Fazbear's. But why is Michael having these nightmares? Why are they important? This retcon can't possibly just be for the purpose of showcasing Michael having PTSD or trauma over what he did at the cost of making the original story of FNAF 4 lose all emotional impact. Can it? Oh boy, this is where we truly get into the weeds, isn't it? If the forest itself isn't tangled like the mess of vines that the villain from Tarzan failed to cut through. Because this is where more recent lore additions have to be included. Specifically, the final chapter in the Tales of the Pizzaplex novel series, Dittophobia. While most of the stories and lore that are within this book series pertains to the more modern games, mainly Security Breach, this is the one sole exception that brings a bit more context to both Final Fantasy IV and its direct sequel, Sister Location. To quickly summarize, the story of Dittophobia revolves around a boy named Rory, who experiences nightmares that are almost beat for beat the same as the ones we see in FNAF 4, locked in a bedroom at night where nightmare animatronics approach him. To be more concise, Bonnie and Chica approach from the hallway, Foxy from the closet, and Freddy lunges from beneath the bed. Despite the persistence of these nightmares, when Rory awakes, he doesn't appear to be bothered by them. The hurdle comes from when he goes to leave his home. He cannot remember nor find where the front door is, and when he calls for his parents' help, he gets no response in return. He wanders and walks around his house over and over again, until he notices the sun is beginning to set through the windows of his home, and almost like a Pavlovian response, he forgets all about how strange it was that he was lost and trapped in his home, and blindly prepares himself for bed, to endure another nightmare, again, and then when he wakes up, the cycle repeats. What Rory later realizes, after his cycle momentarily breaks, is that everything he has been experiencing has been one massive hallucination. Next time he wakes up after the cycle breaks, he notices that he has grown a decade older than he could last recall. The home he was in was not his own, and was filthy and covered in mold, and most importantly, there were tracks in the floor that led down the hallways, his closet, and underneath his bed. And at the end of every track, tattered animatronic mannequins on wheels that he recognized to be the same ones from his dreams were being stored. To make a not long but complicated story shorter and more concise, Rory discovers that he has been part of a simulated experiment where he has been inhaling hallucinatory gas that has altered his perception of reality, an experiment in which whomever was running it behind the scenes wanted to see the results of a child succumbing to night terrors for a prolonged period of time with only the necessary amount of REM sleep in order to survive. And these nightmare animatronics and the area they are contained in bear striking, familiar design choices to what we see in FNAF 4. So, okay. Now we have this strange science experiment attached to this game. So were these dreams not really dreams, but more memories? Are we just supposed to ignore all the blatant reality warping logic present in the game? Sure, there have been abnormal influxes in the environment of FNAF games before, but never like this. So what's going on here? Well, let's break this down, shall we? Despite this new additional information, the gameplay of FNAF 4 is still the product of a dream. It has to be if the previous aforementioned Easter eggs of the FNAF 1 phone call and hospital Easter eggs are to be of any value or purpose. which implies the person who is having these dreams has memories of both FNAF 1 and FNAF 4, something which Rory would not have any memory of, because we know only Michael and Golden Freddy slash the Crying Child will be present for both events. So what was the point of showing these events? What was important to tell the story about Rory seeing this? What does didaphobia even mean? Okay, here we go. It means the fear of repetition. Oh, wait a minute. Into the Night will be right back after these messages.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
A prominent question posed by the FNAF 4 narrative that never gets truly revealed is the reasoning behind the Crying Child's fear of the animatronics, specifically, a fear of the Springlock animatronics. On Night 4, when he passes by other children, we can see that Fazbear Entertainment hasn't yet earned its opprobrious reputation as both a corrupt corporation or an unsafe venue for children to be present in. Every child he passes seems to love the pizzeria, with two children in particular teasing or mocking him for his fear of the animatronics and how, quote, nobody else is scared, so why are you, unquote. Despite the evidence to the contrary, most notably the pigtail girl's comments on the animatronics hiding bodies inside of them, it seems like it can't be the case that the Crying Child saw the missing children's incident. That would make sense why he would be afraid of the Springlock suit. He saw the Purple Man lure and kill children with that costume, and he's now afraid of that because he could be next. It would also add credence to the line in the very next night when he approaches the assortment of plushies of the original Fazbear band, minus Golden Freddy, when he calls them, quote, my friends, unquote. Perhaps he is all alone because he lost all of his friends from the MCI, and he is the last one standing. Unfortunately, despite that theory being pretty astute and clerical, it simply cannot be the case as the game itself takes place in 1983, and as we have previously established, the MCI takes place in 1985, 2 years after the events of this game. So he couldn't have seen the MCI, and that cannot be the result of his trauma. We also know, given his ability to watch the Fredbear cartoons and his love for his plush companions, it isn't the characters themselves he fears, but their mechanical counterparts. So perhaps it isn't so much the Springlock animatronics themselves he is afraid of, rather, more broadly, the child has automophobia and is scared of any version of the Fazbear animatronics. But why? Well, with the information we can now glean from Didophobia, we may have an answer for that. Without spoiling future installments of the series, we know from Didophobia that an organization associated with Fazbear Entertainment was running experiments on children through the use of hallucinogenics to make children endure simulated nightmares with very little sleep, with the nightmares themselves taking the form of disheveled and torn up caricatures of the Fazbear band. So what if, just what if, the reason why the Crying Child is traumatized was because he was one of the test subjects in this nightmare experiment? Sounds kind of crazy, but as we find out in an upcoming game, when Rory begins to search through the facility of this research center, its design and layout is undeniably the setting of Sister Location, which is a large underground testing facility hidden away from public eyes. And what do we also discover to exist that is attached to this facility? An architectural map with the layout of the FNAF 4 bedroom, the plush trap hallway, and the Crying Child's home and Fredbear location present in the minigame cutscenes, all of which are connected to this research facility. So if he was a test subject, That would mean that he could be easily transferred in his sleep from his room to his brand new simulated environment. So, if we go off that idea that the crying child becomes Golden Freddy, a ghostly apparition that takes a faux form of Fredbear, and we extend that to our all but confirmed speculation that Michael is both the Night Guards of at least FNAF 1 and 3, as well as the Foxy Brother of FNAF 4, perhaps we can explain the reason why Michael is having these nightmares, and when he is having them, is not just during the events of FNAF 1, but being given to him by Golden Freddy, his own little brother. After all, we know that Michael could not have been a test subject as we see in FNAF 4. The crying child is the only one whom is afraid of the animatronics, and if Michael endured the same nightmare experiment, he wouldn't belittle nor tease the little brother over his fears. He would most likely relate and sympathize, the latter which could be the reason as to why Michael is having these dreams. Given to him by Golden Freddy, his little brother is showing him what he couldn't believe when they were younger, but now as a Night Guard of Freddy Fazbear's, he can absolutely comprehend now. This isn't exactly far-fetched either. In the Five Nights at Freddy's movie, we see that dreams play a prominent role in the story, with the movie version of Michael utilizing them to relive the events of youth when his younger brother in that universe was kidnapped on a family trip. And in the later half of the story, we see that the spirits of the MCI are not only capable of infiltrating these dreams of Mike when he sleeps in the Freddy Fazbear's Pizza restaurant, but can manipulate them to their own design. While Mike clearly doesn't sleep on the job during FNAF 1, otherwise he would be easily killed, in that same movie we see that Golden Freddy isn't restrained to the restaurant like the other children. So he could have easily followed Mike home so that he could enter into his dreamscape. And this isn't even the first case of spirits or esoteric powers in the FNAF universe altering the dreams of people. In the truthfully questionably canonical, probably not, but still plays by the same rules, Fazbear Fright in the Villa series, in the story Room for One More, a story which setting once again takes place in that clandestine research facility, a Night Guard's dreams are once again infiltrated by enigmatic entities again, producing nightmares where he's tortured and killed by these strange robots. So this isn't far-fetched at this point. It is a pattern that Scott has kept using in his franchise. This explains why the FNAF 4 nightmares have FNAF 1 references, and even hospital references. It's Michael's nightmare, but they have been infiltrated and manipulated by his little brother, Golden Freddy, letting him know that he is not only still here, but also letting him know what exactly happened to him. Why else would Golden Freddy keep telling Mike, "It's me, it's me"? He is letting his older brother know that he is indeed here, a spirit lingering on in the aftermath of the incident. But don't get it twisted, this isn't a case of the little brother being vindictive. Yes, Golden Freddy can kill Michael in FNAF 1, or does he? Comparing to how Golden Freddy behaves in both FNAF 2 and later installments, he is actually quite passive in FNAF 1. On top of his death screen being fairly similar to a certain nightmare animatronic in FNAF 4, I don't think the bite victim would seek out revenge against Michael for his actions, in particular with how the final cutscene in FNAF 4 between the two play out. And no, not the bite of 83, the scene where the crying child is in the void and he hears his older brother apologize despite not being assured that he could even hear him. On top of seeing how Golden Freddy behaves to another person quite aggressively in FNAF 2, especially the infamous purple guy, we see that he is quite more rageful against them rather than Michael. That's why he is showing Michael these visions. He wants him to understand why he is still around, because he was part of these experiments. That is what truly led to his death, not Michael. And he wants him to understand not just what he had endured when they were younger, but why he is still around and still angry and vengeful for the man who put him through that torment and pain of the nightmare experiments. But who could be that person? Well, like I said, he is quite angry and aggressive over a certain purple man. We'll be right back. I'm not even gonna beat around the bush here. The man behind the slaughter and the man behind the nightmare experiments are the exact same person, the purple guy. Sister location reveals pretty early on who owns the facility. It's in the opening cutscene when you start the game. Both the books and the sixth game in the series even further confirm this individual to not only be the man who owns the research bunker, but also the co-owner and co-founder of Fredbear's Family Diner and Fazbear Entertainment, which is why this underground testing and research center has the infrastructure in place that connects it directly to a Fazbear Entertainment venue. They are owned, or at the very least partially owned, and founded by the same individual. And we see in FNAF 4 that this purple man is present lurking in the shadows as always during the time and events of FNAF 4. But it goes even deeper than that. Slight spoilers for Sister Location. But inside this research center, we see in a private room, which we later find out in Didophobia, to be an observation room connected to that nightmare experiment chamber, that there is none other than a plush Fredbear with some kind of walkie-talkie or remote control leaning up against a stack of monitors. If we input the code 1983 on an adjacent keypad, the monitors ignite and display a transmission of the FNAF 4 bedroom and plush trap hallway. An almost omnipresent feature in the FNAF 4 cutscenes is that presence of plush Fredbear wherever the crying child roams. He is everywhere, whether in plush form, Fazbear iconography in the pizzeria, or hiding his face somewhere wherever the crying child roams. And while the crying child can hear his voice from wherever he is, it's a strange omission that he only has white pupils that follow the crying child while he is inside the house. In every other location where his plush Fredbear is outside the house, his eyes are blank. But when inside, all the plushies track his every move. Now, add in this little detail of the Fredbear plushies being associated with correspondence and observation of nightmare experiment test subjects, and it isn't too hard to see the connection the games are trying to implicate. There isn't just one Fredbear plushie. There are multiple inside the house, all tracking and recording the crying child's movements so his actions and behaviors can be recorded, just like how the purple guy recorded Rory's behavior in Didophobia. However, due to the crying child's damaged psyche and lack of parental or familial love inside his homestead, he has developed a coping mechanism in the form of his seemingly alive plush doll by creating an imaginary persona out of him. This is why he sees him everywhere he goes, hiding behind cars, in sewer grates, or most clearly unbelievable, his head is the face of a flower. He is emotionally dependent on him to affirm and reassure him that everything is going to be okay and that he can get through it all. This is also why he can hear him wherever he goes as well. I know some people like to theorize that what Golden Freddy plush has in its hands at Sister Location is a walkie-talkie, but I disagree with this hypothesis. Only the crying child even hears the plush doll, and he hears him even when he isn't isolated and alone. Add into the fact both Michael could never hear the plush doll, and the fact that the purple man would most likely have to be on the other end of the walkie-talkie, and he was busy at Fredbear's while the crying child hears the plush speak to him, we can easily conclude that it can't be a real voice behind the doll's words. Which begs the question, if these dolls were used to monitor the crying child around the house, why were they in there? How did the crying child get transported from his bedroom, his home, to the nightmare experiment testing chamber without his parents knowing about it? Why would his parents allow these plush dolls in their home unless the person who owns the plush dolls also owns the home? And whomever would have owned the home would be the parent of both the crying child and Foxy Brother. Oh yes, indeed. And this isn't even debatable. Future installments, most prevalent being Sister Location, confirm that Michael is indeed the eldest son of the infamous purple guy, and by extension, the crying child is his youngest son. You didn't tell me you didn't see some resemblance in how sadistic Michael was to his younger brother, hiding behind a mask while picking on someone weaker and more feeble than he is. It's just a little less homicidal version of William's actions. Both do seem to enjoy reveling in the fear of their victims, with the purple guy being clearly fascinated by it, Michael finding amusement out of it, and both parties getting a rush out of it. It also explains his abusive behavior toward the crying child as well. Given how distant the purple guy was and how cruel he is, as the eldest, he probably took the brunt of the abuse growing up in the household that is probably molded into a mini purple version of him. And while I won't spoil his location just yet for those following along, for those in the know, you are aware there is many layers to that line implicating Mike being a mirror of his father that proves me right. The purple man used his own youngest son as a test subject for his nightmare experiments, which is why, even though he never directly killed him, he still simulated his death and tortured him through hallucinogenic illusions of monsters he saw as friends. He is still angry and vengeful for his father's actions. Similar to the puppet, he witnessed this monster's actions, which is why he is so willing to hunt him down with the other victims of the MCI and trap him inside that springlock suit, where he would be stuck in agony and pain, just like how they endured it. This is why Golden Freddy doesn't need the puppet to give him the gift of life, like all the others required. As seen in FNAF 4, and then reinforced in both FNAF 2 and 6, he was put back together all by himself. In a way. Now, I know dual spirit theory, the idea that Golden Freddy is possessed by two individuals, hence why it can be so supernaturally prevalent, or the idea that the puppet gave Golden Freddy life, is popular. But if we are to look towards the future of when those theories became popular, it primarily came about as a result of the Fazbear Fright novella having a character called the Stitch Wraith, who was possessed by the souls of two children. However, when this began to be utilized by fans as evidence for Golden Freddy, Scott then made a retroactive choice to have Golden Freddy presented in media to have only one pupil to elucidate that only one soul resided in the machine. Also, there's the fact that the merchandise for Golden Freddy, like the U2's figurine, only has one soul being present, like all the other animatronics, due to Scott being very observant and reactive to whenever Golden Freddy merch releases to be sure that nothing ever strays fans in the wrong path through possible lore implications, yet this design choice was allowed to pass the bar, so I think it's fair to say he is really tired of people using dual theory as gospel. And we had already mentioned previously how Golden Freddy's ability to linger on without the help of the puppet seems to be prevalent story beat, which, given his family, may actually be a bit more credible than once realized. So, then the question has to be asked. What is up with that ending scene? Who is talking to the crying child when he is in the void, telling him that he would, quote, put him back together, unquote? Well, truth be told, I think this one is really up for interpretation. But I can conclude that this section with the two most prominent options. One is this is the purple guy again, talking to him and letting him know that he will put him back together and he will live again. The problem with this is the fact that while learning and studying the supernatural would be a character trait later associated with the purple guy, he hadn't really done anything truly macabre yet at this time. Abusive, abhorrent, and evil, absolutely. And by this point in time, he had at the very least killed a child at Fredbear's family diner. But he had no true understanding nor insight on the supernatural as of this point, would he? Even his nightmare experiments are rooted more so on the emotional responses rather than any preternatural study. And without the MCI curing, I doubt he would even know that his victims have been living on in some other form yet. Not to mention, given how readily he was willing to put his son through these torturous experiments, it is quite doubtful that the purple man would put his kids back together through any kindness of his heart. Reminder that in almost every characterization of the purple guy, in every continuity, he sees his children more as tools rather than people. For examples, let's see here, someone to choose from. We already have Nightmare Experiment and Negligence in the games. In the books, he has a daughter that he punches in the face for wanting to show her greens to him. And in the movie, he once again stabs his daughter in the stomach for daring to defy him. Yeah. Even if he was planning to rebuild his kid, it was not done in any realm out of love. Instead, what if we were to take this passage a bit more literal? What if it still is his imaginary friend talking to him again, but his dreamlike friend isn't so lucid as he was before? To preface, in every cutscene of FNAF 4, whenever a character speaks, the text used to represent their voice is a lighter colored version of their shirt or an object they are holding. The crying child's text is white based on his striped shirt. Michael's light gray, and all the other children have lighter colored text of their shirts. Fredbear's is a nice golden yellow, but when he talks at the very end of the game, the text color alters and becomes a more ivory color. It still speaks as if it's coming from the Fredbear plush. The language and choice of words is implicating that the source has remained the same, but there has been some form of shift. What if the text is there to represent how both the crying child and the Fredbear character are now one and the same? The crying child's white text, mixed with plush Fredbear's font color choice, does mix into a nice middle ground if you combine their color value hex code, and it looks similar to the altered text. It is possible this ending was perhaps a more symbolic one, where he would be able to live after death, that his imaginary friend would allow him to continue on his form until he could find some level of peace, until he received his happiest day that was taken away from him. It would explain the FNAF 3 minigames, would it not? The birthday party for Golden Freddy, the happiest day minigame where the puppet, along with all the victims of the NCI, wearing the mask of those he considered his only friends, which has since repeated itself yet again, are there to make things right. To give him the happiest day he never received, to do the opposite of what had occurred that fateful day. In addition to why the crying child apparates as a visage of Golden Freddy rather than a complete one-to-one of Fredbear, or even possessing an animatronic suit at all. After all, if the victim who possesses Golden Freddy was a child and his body was hidden in one of the suits, it wouldn't be like the animatronics. With all their mechanics, wiring, and such, it would be a hassle. Not to mention downright macabre to think someone stored away a body inside there. But a spring lock suit? One adorned and supposed to be worn by other humans? One would think the body would easily be able to be spotted by the police. Yet, no bodies were ever found. To further elucidate on how this idea is credible, note that even in the Fazbear Fright story, Into the Pit, which its main character Oswald is shown in hallucinatory vision of the aftermath of the MCI, instead of 5 children being present as once displayed in the games, there are 6 victims for him to see. Not to mention Phone Guy's remarks on the first night phone call that the animatronics had been active for over 20 years, yet multiple sources have showcased that Fredbear only began operations in the late 70s, with Fazbear Entertainment coming to fruition shortly after. This is all to say that it is quite possible, given that Scott already changed huge aspects of the original lore in the first game, that some of its elements have been skewed to create a better overall narrative for the series. Am I saying that the MZI only has 4 victims now? No. I am saying that writers make mistakes, and this whole kerfuffle could have been fixed if FNAF 4 was just a bit more coherent with the symbolism and meaning, instead of having to swap through all this information. All this to solve one character, this one crying child's vivid nightmare and death. Oh, wait a minute. Into the Night will be right back after these messages. Okay. Nightmare is an interesting anomaly in FNAF 4. If you ignore, you know, this entire madness spiderweb of lore we've been traversing for the past. Oh my god, that's a runtime. Unlike the rest of the cast of FNAF 4, Nightmare stands out a bit more outlandish. Before we begin discussing more about him, let's break down what we know about Nightmare. For starters, he is a clear color palette swap of Nightmare Fredbear, where instead of yellow fur with purple accessories, he instead has a black, almost translucent fur with gold accessories. In fact, his color scheme is actually the inverse to that of Golden Freddy, and not Nightmare Fredbear. He only shows up on the final 2 hours of Night 7, after the cutscene in which the crying child succumbs to his wounds, and the monster behaves similar to Nightmare Fredbear, but far more aggressive. And when he attacks the player, he does not have a normal jump scare. Instead, an uncanny scream plasters your view, while an eerie high-pitched whirl emits from Nightmare, followed by the game not simply booting you back to the main menu, but the game itself fully resetting after being killed by him. Well, since this character is the complete opposite of almost every other character from FNAF 4, let's tackle this beast in a similar manner by focusing more on debunking theories, then presenting my own. A common theory about Nightmare is that he is another form of Shadow Freddy, that rare entity that could appear in parts and servers room in FNAF 2, and appears in the purple guy cutscenes in FNAF 3. But while there's indeed a possible connection between the two, I don't believe these two are the exact same character. For starters, the difference in appearances between Shadow Freddy and Nightmare when it comes to the design is quite the stark contrast compared to when other animatronics take on a different form in the series, particularly when it comes to Shadow Freddy, whom has never changed his appearance elsewhere, unlike his counterpart Shadow Bonnie, who has only changed once in his minigame in FNAF 3. Yes, Shadow Freddy and Nightmare look similar. They even have the same name in the game files, but, and this is going to hurt to hear for some, that doesn't really matter. Like, by the same logic, there are two Foxy Bros, since Michael has two sprites, and one of them is titled Foxy Man. By the same logic, the Mangle and Funtime Foxy must be the same character, despite the fact that while they share characteristics and even a name, they are two completely separate entities. We can go down the rabbit hole even further, but the point I'm trying to make is that the use of source code information, especially from Scott's earlier work, is probably not the smartest use of theory crafting to hinge a hypothesis on. Besides, this theory also hinges on the idea that the crying child actually becomes Shadow Freddy and not Golden Freddy, which can be debunked through the... I can't believe I have to talk about this too. The Five Nights at Freddy's official character encyclopedia. Sorry, no, I'm okay. I can do this. This book is very important. This book is very important for this theory. While this book has more than a few inaccuracies, and coming from someone who once did graphic design, some of the decisions on cohesiveness and visual appeal makes me want to cry. What's innately important to this book comes from page 210, the section for the crying child. It's here we see that instead of his usual appearance in FNAF 4 as his main portrait, it instead shows him in the form of the ghost children of the MCI in the 8-bit minigames. Don't get me wrong, this same page also states that the Nightmare gameplay is also taking place in the crying child's perspective on the same page. Once again, this book is filled with inaccuracies and is absolutely terrible and not worth your money. But this is custom artwork. Artwork commissioned by Scott for the purposes of visualizing the crying child in this book. And to coincide with this depiction, we have another character portrait of the crying child in his human form with plush Fredbear, and another where we see him crying with the presence of Nightmare leering right behind him. Simply put, the crying child cannot be Shadow Freddy since they are depicted as two separate entities. So why can't Nightmare be Shadow Freddy? I believe to summarize Nightmare as simply Shadow Freddy does a bit of disservice to Scott's ability to symbolically tell a story. Think about what Nightmare does in the game again, and how that connects to its story. It appears only after the crying child's body had fully collapsed. It comes in the form of the inverse of Golden Freddy, and his method of killing you is a jump scare that is quite similar to that of Golden Freddy's in FNAF 1, but instead of killing you, the game itself resets. It resets because he is the final nightmare. A skeletal shadow that represents our greatest fear. Death. The eternal slumber. Think about it. When Nightmare kills you, why does the game reset? In the original game, the death of the player would endure were a component of the story, one of multiple fatalities the crying child endured before reawakening and succumbing to the cycle all over again. But when Nightmare kills the player, it doesn't repeat the same tired cycle. It resets the game. It resets the game because it breaks the cycle. When death claims you, it is the final nightmare. So the crying child will endure that same torturous dream yet again.
What's left?
However, as we have previously established, the story of FNAF 4 has not only been overwhelmingly altered by the whims of Scott's current thinking, but the consequences of that has been the complete transference of the Nightmare gameplay perspective being shifted from the crying child to Michael. So how does Nightmare fit into it here now? Believe it or not, the exact same. Think back to the crying child's final moments. I mentioned how the text of the Fredbear plush dialogue was a mix between the colors of both the crying child's text color and the usual plush Fredbear dialogue. I stated that this was symbolic of how they became one and the same. So who's talking? Nightmare. He is indirectly speaking to death. Once again, Nightmare Fredbear in the next night gets replaced by this shadowy figure. It's literally taking its place. So the question has to be asked, once again, why is Michael being shown this? Well, it really needs no further explanation than what it's already been given. It's the crying child communicating to Michael what had happened to him. Death claimed him, and he was put back together because of it, in the form of what killed him. A Fredbear Springlock suit with all the life removed from it. Further evidence for this comes from Nightmare's altered form, Nightmareon, another form in which it takes on the appearance of a corrupted version of the puppet, literally the inverse of the character that defies death by giving gifts and giving life. Nightmareon is actually worth a discussion all on himself, and luckily, someone has already done just that. Talented FNAF theorist and exceptionally well-dressed Ozone has made a video all about Nightmareon that I highly recommend you check it out. I'll link it in the description below. But given how both these characters have far superior connection to one another than Shadow Freddy, as well as similar symbolic meaning, I think it is safe to say that if one is supposed to be FNAF's interpretation of the Grim Reaper, the other also must follow suit. Oh my god, we still have so much to get through. Alright, let's speedrun this next part. Since we already talked about him, let's go over the Halloween edition real quick. I won't spend too much time talking about it because it was only a free update that came out on October 30th, 2015. It was, for the most part, the same game with a few cosmetic differences. I mean, it's still worth talking about, if only to mention the number of cool monsters we got from the update. We got the Jacko animatronics, Jacobana and Jackio Chica, the almost spider-like Nightmare Mangle, and the previously mentioned fan favorite Nightmareon. None of these characters are considered canon. Well, in this instance, they are not. With the exception of Nightmare Mangle, every single new robot makes a reappearance in either Final Fantasy 37, Ultimate Custom Night, or FNAF VR Help Wanted, as characters made by Fazbear Entertainment for the Freddy Fazbear virtual experience. For example, Nightmareon in the Darkroom levels and Jacobani and Chica make a return in the Halloween DLC. Funny enough, none of the VR animatronics are real, though. Or, at the very least, physically real. They have no conscience or input on the world. They are simply characters that were made by Fazbear Entertainment or the in-universe developers for the Freddy Fazbear virtual experience. Until proven otherwise, that's all those characters are. There are, however, two exceptions to that rule. First, of course, is Nightmareon, whom has a lot of implications in Ultimate Custom Night, which is his first canon appearance, which we have already gone through. The second comes from a new version of Fun with Plush Trap in the Halloween update. It was called Fun with Balloon Boy, and featured a new grotesque gremlin version of Balloon Boy as the main threat to replace Plush Trap. What's interesting about this is that unlike other new characters added into the update, Nightmare Balloon Boy was added to the base game, regardless of which version you play. This isn't by accident. Scott Cawthon himself stated that Nightmare Balloon Boy is indeed canon, and that is the reason he is in both versions. He apparently works in the timeline, and this point is really strange. But when you think about it, the puppet's backstory in the Take Cake minigame does, by extension, make the inference that characters outside the main Fazbear Band have always existed that we have never seen. After all, the puppet had to attach its soul to something when it died if the rules of possession in FNAF are to be followed. And just for the sake of clarity, with the risk of being slightly spoilery, we do see in a future FNAF installment, FNAF 6, that this is indeed the case. This minigame just simply showcases this was also true for Balloon Boy as well. He was a character that existed prior to FNAF 2 that was around similar to the puppet. Beyond that, I don't think there is any other implication the minigame is trying to make. Nightmare Balloon Boy does have a cool voice though. In the original release and Help Wanted, it's just a distorted Balloon Boy stock voice. But Matthew Curtis later provides vocals for UZN, and it is an amazing performance.
You're not so big, just a butt-sized morsel.
Matthew Curtis also has a couple song covers in which he performs as Nightmare Balloon Boy, as well as another finance of his character, Music Man. You know what, I'll also link his channel in the description as well if you wish to listen. Alright, I have pushed this long enough. Let's talk about the most magnifying, controversial mystery this game has to offer that has tormented fans for years. After completing Night 7 or Nightmare Mode, you will be greeted with a locked box. Well, maybe not so much a box, but a chest. The chest has two locks on it, and clicking on them will only cause them to jiggle a bit before returning to their stationary position. After a while, a message will appear above the box. Quote, "Perhaps some things are best left forgotten for now." Unquote. For almost a decade, this has been sealed. Every now and then, we have always gotten a little glimpse, a tease of what could be inside the box, but never a full confirmation. And Scott himself stated back in 2015 that he didn't want the box opened anymore. Quote, "Some things are best left forgotten forever." Unquote. Ever since then, this box has been the bane of a Five Nights at Freddy's fan existence. Most believe that the answer to every major mystery and question is contained within this box. If only we could open it, we would learn the secrets, but alas, it remains closed. Speaking only from perspective of a writer, I think this was a terrible decision. I stand by my previous statement that FNAF 4 as a lone story is actually very good. The writing is solid, the emotions are palpable, and the gameplay is actually pretty well done. The problem comes down to it being associated with the prior three games in the series. It was dubbed the final chapter, and it was a mainline entry. Thus, there is an expectation that it's following up on what the previous works had built upon. But FNAF 4 is so isolatory in its writing and place in the universe. We know when it takes place, but we have no true way of confirming why it is taking place. What is the game trying to reveal, showcase, or inform us about? Sure, we get the backstory from Michael, but that would become prevalent until the next two games in the series, and there wasn't exactly a way for the audience to put that together yet. This box was, in many ways, the solution to that problem. This was the missing anchor that could have been used by Scott to give that conclusive, satisfactory reason as to why we are seeing these events unfold. But because he never opened it, because it basically became Schrodinger's box, what's inside has the answers, but until you open it, you have no idea if either the answers are satisfactory or worthless. Until it is opened, it is both. Scott himself has also stated that the contents within have changed over time. As I said previously, Final Fantasy's canon is the consequence of Scott's thoughts moving forward and the cumulative impact of his prior work. Some artists may be more thoughtful than others, but Scott will tell you he's no genius mastermind. so we will never know what's inside that box. But if I had to guess what was inside, I theorize we would have seen a Fredbear Springlock suit. Specifically, one that looked exactly like Golden Freddy. A confirmation that this was the one whom the crying child becomes before it has since shifted and became nothing more than a faux conclusion. Two events yet, still unsatisfied. And with that, I believe that brings us to a good stopping point for tonight's episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to stay updated, please consider subscribing, following, or sharing this podcast. It truly helps us broaden our reach. Consider following us on our Twitter at Fazbear Podcast, joining our Discord, or supporting us on our Patreon or merch store using the various links in the description of this episode. With the conclusion of Final Fantasy IV, we can now shift our focus to the next game in the series and my personal favorite, Sister Location. The narrative continues to follow Michael as he embarks on his new role as a late-night technician for the highly advanced animatronic entertainment venue, Circus Babies Entertainment and Rentals. Throughout this installment, we will delve deeper into the twisted family dynamics of Michael and the crying child, while also uncovering the identity of the mysterious purple guy. I'm eager to embark on this journey with all of you. Once again, I have been your host, Nick, and thank you once again for listening. Have a good night, and drive home safe.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.